This is episode Echo of the Software Freedom Law Show. Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Software Freedom Law Show. It's been an exciting 2 weeks since the last show, I think.
Well, I don't know if I would say exciting, but certainly eventful. Things have happened that hadn't happened yet.
So. It's true, and actually our guest today, and I still feel like there's something special about holding on to announcing the guest, even though I know you know who it was. But
I'll go through it again. It's in the show notes. It's in the title of the episode. It's on the website where people download the episode from. It's in the RSS feed that people download the episode from.
But we made a joint announcement this week with
you're not even going to acknowledge that I pointed this out at
you. Organization that with whom our guest works. And I guess since everybody has A, read the news, and B, knows that the guest is from the Free Software Foundation, what I'm referring to is the FSF and Cisco settlement. So a suit that has been ongoing has been settled.
Yep, and we were representing FSF in that endeavor and helped make that happen. And I think we're all glad that it's behind us now on all sides. And now it's the time to ask FSF what's next, as the fake president in West Wing always says. What are they going to work on? What's the new focus for them? And that's what we're going to be talking to John about in a few minutes.
So we'll be back soon with,
but you said it's an eventful week, and you just say one event? You're not going to say the two things that happened in the last 2 weeks?
I would say that this particular second event is not as momentous.
Oh, you're just being humble because you yourself.
But I had much less involvement in this particular.
Oh, but over time you've been working a lot.
I have been working for a long time.
I'm not trying to build you up, and you keep interrupting me. Here, I want to say that Karen has been doing some very important work that is very boring.
Well, we did get criticism in previous episodes that that Bradley had been interrupting me, so I thought maybe if I interrupted him.
It's a very good point. It was actually my wife who made that criticism, to tell you the truth.
Anyway, so what we're referring to in this particular instance is that I'm an advisor for the American Law Institute's Principles of the Law of Software Contract. And the American Law Institute abbreviates as the ALI. And they basically try to promulgate a set of rules and interpretations of the laws in particular areas that will function as recommendations in the future that that courts can look to and other people can look to for what the state of the law is and how the statute should be interpreted. And so the one that I was participating in was the law of software contracts. And so, for a few years now, the ALI has been working with these drafts, and, you know, we and others have been giving their feedback. And what's great about this process is that the ALI has actually moved quite a bit from their original draft to the draft that was looked at this week. And this week at the meeting, the draft was actually adopted by the ALI. So it's not in its quite final form yet, but it's in its near final format. I think there are probably some changes to the comments and discussions, but it has come a long way. And I won't bore you guys with the details of it, but I would say that, you know, you may have heard that there's some dispute about the warranties. The warranties have actually moved a long way from where they had been. I think there are protections for developers who are working on free software, especially as one-off and perhaps not as sophisticated as other developers, as companies that are working in this area. And there's a specific section about the discussion of remedies under copyright law, even though there may be a breach of contract. Anyway, so that's sort of, as we say, insider baseball.
Yeah, but I think it's important that, you know, that folks understand that this is the kind of work that we have to do, and sometimes this long negotiation stuff that happens in these kinds of organizations end up affecting people that don't realize it. You know, if it weren't for you going there, I certainly wouldn't know about that we had to worry about ALI's recommendations about software agreements.
I would say they're not at the 100% ideal. They're not perfect. They're not what we would have drafted if we were drafting them. But they have come such a long way, and they've listened to a lot of criticism. So I think it's actually a fairly successful draft.
That's what other folks say about the GPLv3 process anyway, to us. So, you know, I figure it's fair if we end up having to say that about them, I would think.
Yeah, we might wind up talking about this in more detail at some later.
Yeah, but I just wanted everybody to get a quick update since it just had happened in the last few weeks, mm-hmm. and you'd been working on it so arduously for it's been almost a year, I guess, at least.
It's been 2 years.
2 years, yeah.
Yeah,
I believe
so.
Going to these meetings and so forth, yeah.
Yeah.
So that's more important work that we do for the free software world.
And for you.
That's true enough. And next we're going to hear about another organization doing some useful work for you for the advancement of software freedom. And we'll be back with our interview with John Sullivan. So, Karen, today we have our first repeat organization guest. We had Brett Smith on a show a while ago who works on the licensing compliance mm-hmm. stuff at FSF. And today we have John Sullivan from the FSF who works on the campaigns there as the manager of operations. John, welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Oh, we're always glad to have somebody from the FSF on. So why don't you start out by telling all our listeners about the various campaigns that you guys do. I think most people are familiar more with the licensing and software development side of the FSF, but the campaigns are really interesting. I think people would love to hear about them.
Sure. So the FSF really got into this kind of campaigning approach first during the GPLv3 process, which was an international process that involved lots of people from the free software community. And so out of that, we also started moving into some different campaigns to tackle issues that came up as a result of that process. So we started Defective by Design as a campaign to focus on digital restrictions management, or DRM, and the threats that poses to free software. And then more campaigns followed after that, like playog.org, which is our campaign to help promote free media formats that aren't restricted by patent or copyright. And the best known examples of those are Ogg Vorbis and Ogg Theora. So we've been doing a lot of work to get producers to use those formats and to help users be able to enjoy them on their computers. We also had Bad Vista, which was a campaign against Microsoft Windows Vista adoption, encouraging people to take that moment where they were installing a new operating system to install a free software, GNU Linux system, instead of Vista. So those are the major ones. We've also had an ongoing kind of umbrella campaign called Libra Planet, which is an effort to unify or organize small free software groups around the world to help them share information that's beneficial that other groups have worked on, so that if they're trying to get free software used in their local school or in their local government, there's letter text and strategies and experiences for them to learn and benefit from that other groups have already tried and had success with.
Was Libra Planet, I seem to remember, was that also the name of did you also have a conference at the same time as the FSF members meeting?
We did. This last year we expanded our usual FSF member meeting into a full conference mm-hmm. and called it Libra Planet. And we did that for a few reasons. The Libra Planet wiki at libraplanet.org actually grew out of the FSF members meeting a few years ago, where we actually had everybody in a room start this wiki where they were adding different ideas for free software activism and specifying their location on the wiki so that other people could find them and get in touch. And so that was kind of the inspiration for also changing the name of the event this year to Libra Planet. And so going forward, we hope that event will be a place where people from around the world that are part of these groups can come and meet in person and hack on things together and get updated on what the recent issues are and meet each other.
Yeah, I think one of the challenging things about this kind of campaigning is you have to go through a lot of steps. You first have to explain the issue to the people you're trying to reach, and then get them active about the issue. And I think one of the best campaigns and most successful campaigns you've done is Defective by Design, and you really did take that issue from starting with people not really knowing it was an issue at all mm-hmm. to taking people to be really aware. Can you walk our listeners through that process of how do you plan that campaign so that you can get from point A to point B?
Sure. It's I mean, in a lot of ways, campaigns happen when there's a the campaign in a lot of ways is a response to something that happened. So there were so many people having negative experiences with DRM. People losing their music files that they had paid for, people not being able to use their music files on a different computer, and then the issues that we were running into during the GPL v3 process with people using DRM to restrict free software directly, so that while you might on paper have the freedom to modify a piece of software that's on your TiVo or other embedded device, there's a security system that prevents you from actually installing anything that you've modified by the mere fact that you have actually made a change to it. The device doesn't recognize your software and says, no, I'm not going to run that. So people were encountering those issues more, and that gave us an opportunity to build something more organized out of that. And the more unique thing about the Defective by Design campaign was the way that we actually sort of took it to the streets, or actually got people out at events on, not just in cyberspace or on the internet, but at the Microsoft Developers Conference, at Apple Stores, at the movie premiere of Pirates of the Caribbean. Doing that was a big challenge for us, because it's very difficult to get people, especially the people that tend to follow the Free Software Foundation are not historically the people that the same people that are inclined to go out and make noise like that. So, but in this process of doing this, we discovered that there actually are a lot of people that do want to do that and do want to use that, take that approach to getting the message out to the public. So I guess in terms of how we do it, for any individual action, we sort of identify who needs to be targeted with this, who do we need to be talking to, and what do we need to say to them. So target in a message, and then how we're going to get that information succinctly and accurately out to people who are interested, building up a mailing list and building up different channels for contacting people. And then from there on, it's pretty much up to the specifics of the action, what we have to do in order to pull it off and make it happen.
Yeah, one of the most the most iconic things that has stayed around from the Detected by Design campaign are the stickers and that image of the parody of the iPod commercials that you guys did.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. And one of the things that I think is so interesting about it is I think sometimes the FSF gets some flack for caring about the way we talk about certain ideas. And what I love about Defective by Design is that what you did was you reframed the issue to tell people about what was actually going on. And so you not only combined that great descriptive language with Defective by Design with also these really powerful images. I think that was really successful.
Yeah, I'm curious to know the legacy of the history of those images. How did that come? Who thought of that, and how did it come about? What led you guys to think of parodying the iPod commercial, which was just genius?
The imagery has been definitely a very important part of that campaign. I mean, right from the beginning, the first campaign action that got noticed was at the Microsoft Developers Conference, where people that were there put on these bright yellow hazmat suits, to show that the fact that DRM was hazardous to people and needed to be removed, and sort of ran around in the streets, in these suits, and made for great video and really got people's attention. So from that, right from the get-go, the campaign was focused on having strong images, and the iPod commercials are just begging, really, to be parodied, I think. The imagery already is striking, and anytime you have a striking image, you can see lots of different variations that you could do on it. So I think all these ideas really emerged pretty collaboratively. We had meetings and discussions with people from Civic Action, which was a group that helped get this campaign started. So Henry Poole, one of the FSF board members, and a couple people that were working with him, Gregory Heller in particular. We would just have the discussions about what to do next in the campaign, and each time throw out some ideas for different images that we could go with.
And so you guys are continuing to launch new campaigns. I noticed you had an essay recently that really caught my eye because it connected up two issues I think people generally see as very separate in our community. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that essay that you wrote and sort of those two ideas and how that fits in with your campaign work.
Right. So we have been involved in a lawsuit in defending against the lawsuits that the recording industry, the RIAA, has been pushing against individuals that they accuse of illegal copying. And we've been doing that mainly by working with Ray Beckerman, an attorney who runs the Recording Industry versus the People blog. And what we've been doing is submitting briefs in some of these cases to talk about the dangers of the way that the RIAA is trying to use copyright against people. And we also provide a fund, the RIAA Expert Witness Fund, which helps fund experts to testify on behalf of the people that are being targeted by the RIAA. And people being targeted tend to be not have the resources to defend against this kind of lawsuit. So the strategy is pretty much to intimidate people into settling, never have these things go to trial. So we're trying to provide resources on the other side so that people can stand up to this effort to extend copyright.
That's really great. Oh, I'm sorry for interrupting you. But I wanted to actually take a step in here because when we first started talking about this podcast and we were saying that we were going to talk to you about this issue, I first said, well, you know, it's related to what we, you know, it's related to free software, of course, but, you know, what, you know, I think it was sort of an interesting topic for us to settle on. And then Bradley pointed me to your essay, which I thought was really interesting, where you tied in why the Free Software Foundation is particularly concerned with this idea, which I thought was really fascinating. And if you could tell our listeners a little bit about that tie-in.
Right. So the title of the essay was actually The War on Sharing, Why the FSF Cares About RIAA Lawsuits. And it was a response to that question. There were people who wondered why we were getting involved. It seems to be, at first glance, to be a little bit off mission for free software. But the copyright is, while it does say specific things about different specific media, a lot of things about copyright extend to any work that is covered, you know, regardless of whether that's a piece of music or a piece of software. And so we do need, first of all, to be concerned with the type of precedents that the RIAA is setting under copyright law in these lawsuits. And by and large, the precedents are very harmful, potentially, to free software. They make copyright seem like something that is a very powerful, natural form of property rather than what it actually is, which is a contingent bargain between that the government is supposed to be representing the public side of, where we grant temporary monopolies to people so that they will then produce things that will benefit everybody, you know, forms of knowledge or entertainment and culture. And that needs to not become some kind of permanent fixed right where you get awarded outrageous amounts of money when somebody, you know, infringes on it. So there are also other effects from these lawsuits that we're concerned about. The RIAA uses them as a justification to have control over technology that's important to the free software movement. They've used these lawsuits as leverage to claim that they should be able to monitor people's internet connections to make sure that they're not illegally sharing files, to crack down on different technologies like peer-to-peer distribution and forms of protocols like BitTorrent that are used widely in the free software movement, even try to make it mandatory that people lock down their wireless access points so that they can reliably identify a single individual with a single wireless access point or a single IP address. All of those things have knockdown effects on very productive uses of that technology, and prime example of which is the International Free Software Movement. And the final reason we were concerned about it is the culture that it creates, where people assume that you're not allowed to copy something until they are told explicitly otherwise, and that causes problems for us. There was a school teacher in Austin who got a student in trouble for passing out free software discs in their class because they assumed that, like anything, it was restricted by copyright and so should not be passed around the class. So you have a situation where someone is trying to hand out useful, beneficial information with their classmates and their peers, and they're being told that that's illegal. And the fact that these lawsuits appear in the headlines constantly really feeds into that perception.
Yeah, that last story there reminds me of an interview I did once right when peer-to-peer file sharing became popular, you know, like in 2002 or so. And it took me about 15 minutes to explain to the journalist that it was possible to legally share something on a peer-to-peer mm-hmm. network, because if she assumed, well, they're just copying things they're not supposed to. And I had to give the example of, well, imagine if the student had to read Hamlet and they forgot until the night before and the library and the bookstore were closed. They could download Hamlet on a peer-to-peer network and it would be legal. And she actually said, isn't Hamlet protected by copyright? I suppose that Disney would wish that Shakespeare's copyrights were still active, but fortunately they are not, if they ever existed in the first place, which I don't even know.
Well, this is a situation we're in now, where in 90 years people are going to be looking back, and we would hope that they would be able to laugh about something produced today still being under copyright like we can about Shakespeare, but unfortunately we've set ourselves up where that's not the case. Things are, first of all, restricted by copyright for a very long period of time now, and on top of that are restricted by DRM systems, which don't expire under the DMCA. That will be, an obstacle for as long as those systems are in use.
Just to take a step back for our listeners, because I think we've actually covered a lot of legal ground during that last little bit, I would say we're actually talking about three different things, legally speaking. One is we're talking about the basically copyright coverage and applicability, and we're talking about how works are copyrighted for a certain period of time, and then they do what we call is fall into the public domain. And that means that the term limit has expired and it's available to be used freely. The second thing we were talking about slightly before that is fair use. So that even if something is covered by copyright, it can still be used for certain purposes. For example, education, which I think is what you were, the primary use that you were talking about in the Austin case. So there are certain uses for which the laws are constructed so that we have a public interest in being able to use some of that work. So, and we'll probably talk more about this when you're not on the line with us, but I wanted to step in while we were talking about it. And the third thing is the regulations under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or the DMCA, which has a separate provision which restricts circumventing, so using technological measures to circumvent copyright. And it's actually a really bizarre situation where there's criminal liability for circumventing those measures, where they're implemented. So those are sort of like the three components here. So sorry for busting in here.
It's a good, important point to make, I think, because it's pretty clear that the RIAA is opposed to the expiration of copyright, even though it's constitutionally mm-hmm. mandated. They're clearly against fair use. And they're in fact one of the major catalysts behind getting the DMCA passed back in 2000. So all three of those things are things mm-hmm. that, the RIAA is basically in direct opposition to the free software community on. But it's interesting that I think, John, and I'd like to hear sort of the FSF answer on this, is that the licenses that the FSF has produced are in fact copyright licenses. So mm-hmm. a lot of people argue that we should just stick in the arms race, and let GPL keep extending along with the RIAA copyright. So what's the answer to that about how the system's being used by the free software world?
Right. That was actually how this relates to the GPL was definitely a prime question that came up in Flash got comments and others talk about our involvement in the RIAA lawsuits, and the GPL does benefit in a way when copyright is extended. It means that free software can keep those protections for a longer period of time, and we are in a situation where we actually use copyright. So from Microsoft's point of view, copyright is only one way in which they make proprietary software and enforce those restrictions on users. They also use things like end-user licensing agreements and contracts or patents as separate mechanisms to restrict users. And so if copyright goes away, they only lose one tool in their arsenal for restricting users. But from our perspective, in order to try to defend against those threats, we actually use copyright to also help defend against threats from patents and those end-user licensing agreements, because the GPL, under the authority of copyright law, is able to take some measures that help guard users against those threats as well. So if copyright were to be eliminated tomorrow, there's a good argument that the free software movement would actually be hurt more than proprietary software producers. And that's a situation that we don't want to be in. We won't be supporting ways of changing copyright that undercut the free software movement without ensuring that software will, through some other mechanism, remain free. But at the same time, the end goal here, you know, we need to keep the eye on the prize, so to speak, is to have a world in which sharing is very easy and encouraged and is seen as a valuable thing in our society as it should be. And copyright in strong terms and strong restrictive terms does get in the way of that. So we will gladly support measures that reduce the amount of time that copyright applies for and you know, other measures to make it more sane and true to its original purpose of a means to ensure that that works of culture and scientific knowledge are produced in our society. You know, we'll support those measures as long as they don't get in the way or cut our legs out from under us, essentially.
Yeah, and I think that when you take a look at the brief you guys filed, you actually specifically predicate your whole argument on preventing the RIA from redefining copyright law. So I think that's really interesting. And what I think also bears mentioning is that in the brief, you're basically advocating against these heightened damages. So basically these very, very high punishments for, that these companies are advocating for, which is obviously the completely different approach than the FSF takes towards the same idea of copyright.
That's right. We use copyright more as a teachable moment for, you know, interacting with companies that are involved in free software. Companies being it's generally when there's a problem with somebody not following the GPL, it usually has to do with the company incorporating free software into their proprietary product in some way. And so copyrights and the GPL give us the legal authority to be able to step in and say, hey, you know, you have to actually make this code available for other people to use just like it was available for you to use. And we're much more interested in that kind of thing than we are in saying, oh, and by the way, you owe us, you know, $150,000 for every time you violated the license. That kind of thing is just outright obnoxious and not appropriate for what the original vision of the law here is.
Yeah, I don't want to end the interview without acknowledging something that I just thought was almost unbelievable. If I hadn't seen it with my own eyes, I wouldn't believe it, which was that the RAA directly called you guys out as an amicus, saying, you know, various negative things about the FSF in the press. And I was just, I don't think that happened. Certainly, I've never seen it before. Maybe Karen, if you know if this happens more often than I realize, but I think it's likely an extremely rare thing that a party in a suit calls out one of the amici in the briefs like that. Is that common, Karen?
Oh, you know, I don't know, but I actually
I've never
don't
seen it
know,
before but, myself. You know,
but I'd be surprised if it didn't happen before.
I'm sure it's happened before, but I you know, given the number of lawsuits you know that I've followed for basically sure. free software issues, that I've never seen in 10 years since I've been following this kind of stuff, somebody go after somebody who filed an amicus brief. I'm curious to hear how did you guys react around the office. I can imagine you guys were actually thought it was pretty cool that you got that level of attention for your message, but it was kind of funny to see, really.
Yeah, it was. It was kind of like that moment when Bill Gates first uttered the, you know, the word GPL. It does seem to be an unusual thing. At least Ray Beckerman thought that he was surprised to see it and thought that it was a sign that they were, you know, didn't have much to say in terms of responding to the legal arguments and were hoping to disqualify the brief on the basis of who submitted it. Mm-hmm. It was very odd to me because my understanding of those briefs, as I said in the article, is that that's the purpose, is that the people who submit them feel that their interests would be affected by the outcome of this case in some way, and that's why they're there providing useful information to the court about the importance of that interest and why the court should care about it. But, you know, in our case, we're not representing something about the FSF's profit interest here. We're representing an important aspect of the public interest and trying to make sure that that gets heard in those cases and that it isn't treated as, you know, somebody as simple as somebody shared a file and therefore has to pay up. You know, it's a lot more complicated than that, and it's important that courts consider the wider ramifications on other sectors of society when they're hearing those cases.
Definitely. It was a very strange argument, particularly when your brief was so focused, and I thought very well written, too.
Yeah, so we do want to wrap up a little bit. Is there any other things going on you want to make sure the public knows about? Any sort of websites they should go to for the current campaigns or anything you want to have people take a look at?
Yeah, there are. There's two things. One is that we're actually going to be hiring a second campaigns manager, because we've been on the topic of organizing FSF campaigns here, and that's a really central position in working on Defective by Design and Playog and all the other work that we do here in that area. So we just put that advertisement up, and we expect to be looking for applications for it for a while to come. So if people are listening to this and interested in this kind of thing, it would be great if they would avail that opportunity. And the second thing is, for where we're headed next, we're really putting a lot of focus on Libre Planet and as a place for free software activists to pool their resources and work that they've done in the past. So if people want to contribute texts that could be used in these different campaigns, that would be a great place to put them.
Well, I just want to note that we'll put links to those two things, as well as the article we were talking about, everything we've talked about here in the show notes, so people should check the show notes if they want to sort of read up on the web to follow up.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. This is very interesting.
Thank you. Thanks a lot, John.
Thank you.
Bye.
I love talking about the RIAA stuff.
Yeah, it's been interesting to me to think about, you know, because I spent a lot of years in free software advocacy trying to tell people, you know, the copyright on software is different than the way copyright works. But the issues are interrelated because they're using this basically blunt tool object of copyright law to affect a whole host of different works, and it all ends up interacting.
It's true, and if you redefine the way you discuss and treat copyright in one context, it affects every other context in which copyright is used as well. So I guess this is a good opportunity to talk about, for me to give a little plug to questioncopyright.org. Because
yeah, you've been doing some work on the side to help them.
Work
you?
On the side. Yeah. It makes it sound very shifty.
Well, it's volunteer work.
But
I don't think volunteer work for a nonprofit can ever be shifty.
No, it's true. And actually, it's funny because I was completely convinced, not that I really needed convincing, but I was convinced and very interested in hearing from John about how, you know, the way in which the FSF has gotten involved with this issue. But because Question Copyright's work isn't really necessarily coming from the free software perspective, it's not a Software Freedom Law Center type of project. So I do it as a volunteer at nights and weekends. But it was actually started, the inspiration came from the free software movement because it was started by Carl Fogel, who we know through his work on Subversion. Mm-hmm. So, and questioncopyright.org is an organization that he started basically to reframe the discussion about copyright law. So all the things that we sort of touched on before are things that he's very interested in. Why, you know, why do we treat copyright the way it does? It essentially grants a monopoly, and it's time to rethink that, particularly as it you know, involves different works of art and music and how it impacts artists. So that's one of the things that that's definitely worth checking out if you want to know more about these issues.
And also, you recently visited the EFF to give a talk and heard some things there, too, about
this
issue. Oh,
yeah. You know, it's funny, because I was just thinking about that when we were talking about fair use in there, and I just, you know, interjected with it, because I think that sometimes we get the legal analyses confused, and it prevents us from articulating, you know, what is acceptable and what we object to. And so I did want to, you know, point out what I wanted to take a moment to focus on fair use, and that was one of the things that we talked about at the EFF. So I participated in a day-long event with the EFF called, it was a bootcamp for startups, and Corinne gave a great speech on fair use. So what was really neat about that is she showed a lot of different circumstances of copyright usage and asked us to, you know, ask the audience to figure out what we thought was fair use and what it wasn't. Of course, you know, it was somewhat loaded with lawyers in the audience, but, you know, who are very familiar with fair use. And some of us, like, you know, like me and the other lawyers at the EFF, of course, are very strong in our views about fair use and consider almost every usage she demonstrated as fair use. But anyway, so that's another thing to check out, and I believe the EFF has some materials specifically dedicated to understanding fair use that might be worth checking out. And we'll put some links in the notes for all this stuff.
Yep, definitely. And it was good to have FSF on again. So now we've seen both sides of FSF, the GPL hacking licensing compliance side, and now the campaign side through John.
It's pretty great because this is a side that we don't see as much because it's not as tied to our work with
right.
the FSF.
Yeah, exactly. But I think it's actually
every bit
what
as
a lot
important.
Of people see out in the community.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I think that wraps up our show for this particular episode, and we'll look forward to talking to you all again in 2 weeks.
Thanks for joining us. The Software Freedom Law Show is produced by Dan Lynch of HalfBakedMedia.com. Thanks to Mike Tarantino for our theme music. This show is released under the terms of the Creative Commons Attribution No Derivative Works 3.0 United States license. We could demonstrate fair use for them.
With what?
Like 5 seconds of Prince?
There's no Unicode symbol for that weird name of his.